to color each of my rolls with a different crayon or brush. My old pal, Mother Nature, has done me quite the solid by bestowing upon me a thick mane of hair and a rampant growth of whiskers, both excellent basic materials from which to sculpt wildly differing character details. I have deeply relished my opportunities to try disparate hairdos, from mohawk to hippie, and the same goes for the facial bush, from Grizzly Adams' beard to mutton chops to Swanson's stash. The peculiar thing is, people familiar with my television work now seem to expect me to wield the mustache at all times, when in reality I will wear it seldom outside of the shooting season. Having enjoyed my life as an aspiring chameleon thus far, I look forward to many more years of it. Parks and Recreation films for 7 months of the year, and when I add on the month of mustache growth to prepare for the season's launch, that's 8 months, or two-thirds of my year, that I'm locked into that look. Therefore, I take great pleasure in spending my off months looking like anything but Ron Swanson. Sometimes I shave my head bald, and sometimes I grow a large shaggy beard, and either direction sees me happy as a clam. For an actor, donning a character is a strange transaction. Ron Swanson, for example, does not belong to me, and so I cannot in good conscience be him when I am not at work with his co-creators, my boss, and the writers of my show. It's like the Iron Man suit. As much as Robert Downey Jr. loves to play that particular iteration of Tony Stark, it would hardly be appropriate, though yes, it would be awesome, for him to wear that suit to the grocery store or the beach. It's no different than the uniform anyone wears at work. Wearing Ron Swanson in my regular civilian life would feel to me commensurate with a Best Buy employee putting on that blue shirt and proselytizing to strangers at the car wash on the virtues of high-def televisions. I will have to be satisfied with the amazing good fortune bestowed upon me that it's what I get to wear whilst working at the greatest job anyone has ever had. By the way, for those of you listening to this book, you're missing some excellent illustrations that are featured in the print version of the book. For example, there is a list of acceptable and unacceptable versions of facial hair. The acceptable versions have names like The Minimum, The Tracker, The Trucker, and Mr. Natural. And some of the unacceptable forms of facial hair are listed as Emasculator, The Douchebag, Bruce, Prison Pussy, The Nut Smudge, The Fop, Minus Balls, and finally, The Joke. To see what these different facial hairs look like, I recommend picking up a copy of the printed version. Available from E.P. Dutton, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Chapter 10. Wax On, Wax Off. Without teachers in our lives, we would be a bunch of sorry dullards indeed. Dimwits and dunces. One of the many gratifying advantages of mammalian life is that the older generation tends to teach the youngsters the skills they need to thrive in these harsh elements. I can tell you nice folks as a flat fact that were it not for the teachers in my own experience, not only would I be unable to extricate the toilet paper from the roll, but I would not ever have even found my way to the John. My parents, naturally, have been my first and best teachers, along with their respective families who shared in the chores. Many hands make light work, and a little handful of joy like myself, not to mention my little brother, two sisters, and a bunch of cousins, provided a workload that was equal to an army of aunts, uncles, and grandparents. Dad first taught me to drive a clutch, followed by my uncles Don and Dan and grandpas Mike and Ray. Each threw in his 2 cents, instructing both me and my cousin Ryan, so that by the time we were 9, after years of gentle lessons, I could engage the consarnate transmission without any crunching. Grandpa Mike's teaching was especially efficacious. He was an old man who didn't have time for maneuvering, so he just went straight at us. I believe Ryan and I were 6 or 7 when he asked us if we would like to sample a chaw of the Red Man chewing tobacco forever in a pouch in his hip pocket. Well, you bet your ass we wanted to try it. Not only did the patriarch of our lives favor this masticating medium, but so did most of our favorite Chicago Cubs. The time had arrived for us to join the Legion of Men, moving mountains of hay and oceans of yellow corn about the county. Grandpa gave us each a portion and said, "Now you just chew it like chewing gum." We complied, champing away in a manner worthy of any swaggering jack down at the grain elevator, if I do say so myself, lasting all of 90 seconds before we both promptly vomited in the yard and lay down in the grass to die. Class complete. Grandpa Mike wasn't fucking around. Later, in my ongoing career as a student, I was to win the teacher lottery not once but twice at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Champaign-Urbana. Permit me to wax on, now, if you will, as I unfold the ballad of Robin and Sato Sensei. Robin McFarquhar was my movement teacher. In any given year, he shouldered a variety of classes, like stage combat, circus techniques, deep tissue massage, mask work, intro to your spine, tai chi, and guts. I also took an independent study in piss and vinegar with him. Every student in the department, both undergraduate and graduate, fell under his gentle British wing, and Robin did everything in his power to heap learning upon our virgin, sponge-like spirits and bodies. McFarquhar, with his actions, illustrated to me a quality that I have really learned to look for in an instructor, that he or she be one who continues to indulge in a hungry course of learning for him or herself. When he wasn't laying some delicious tutelage upon us, which meant mainly during summer vacation, Robin was traveling the nation and the world, participating in workshops of all sorts, from Feldenkrais to Alexander technique to stage combat to literally walking on coals. That might sound extreme to you, or at least a tad hocus-pocus, but let me assure you it was anything but. For he would dutifully return to his classroom every fall and do his utmost to inspire us to perform that very act in all of our work, walk on fire. Robin's movement syllabus at the U of I Theater School generally taught one to know and understand the instrument of one's body, along with its possibilities and limitations. Imagine any time you've begun a new program of exercise and some long unused muscle group speaks up and says, "Hey, whoa, 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 you've paid us no attention whatsoever for these 27 years, and now you want us to perform repeated sets of lat pulldowns? Take it easy, sailor." We got acquainted with all of the disparate muscular work teams in our own operations, especially those crews handling the spine, that finicky nerve center from whence all bodily motion springs. Once we had socialized with all of the labor divisions, we then put our company to work in tasks requiring both finesse, juggling, mime, court sword, and brawn, backflips, broadsword, wrestling. As you might recall from your own school days, the divergent realms of theater nerds and athletes seldom experienced any crossover, and so Robin was teaching us merely to be athletes before we could begin to participate in his artistic decathlons. As amazingly delivered as these disciplines were, they were mostly dealing with the vessel. If it was whiskey school, these classes focused on the barrel, with its distinct cooperage, the tinctures in which the oak staves had previously bathed, the truing of the hoops, and the application of peat smoke in some exceptional cases. But continuing this well-distilled analogy, the real pedagogical treasures in Robin's classroom concerned the spirits contained within the cask. The man taught us guts, plain and simple. At the top of every session of circus class, the assembled troupe would recite, "Come to the cliff," he said. They said, "We are afraid." "Come to the cliff," he said. They came. He pushed them, and they flew. The sense of it is, Come to the edge of the cliff, face the leap, and be afraid. Then acknowledge your fear, step forward once more, and then push yourself off the cliff. I was lucky, as I was already stupid, so I was ready to take any flying vault that people would watch, but for many of the softer students, ones who had enrolled in the program aspiring to become the next Molly Ringwald, the prospect of attempting a backflip was terrifying stuff. Every one of us was gently coaxed toward overcoming his or her own insecurities, and as a result, flying like a motherfucking eagle. These classes took all of the good parts of self-help ideology and the religious mindset and employed them with the sole objective of instilling self-confidence and creativity in the participants. One of the greatest epiphanies a performer can take on board is the understanding that one must simply fly free. Your flight may be beautiful and sexy, hi there, or it may be awkward and labored, hello. It might be hilariously encumbered by disheveled feathers and an ill-kept beak, or it might be workmanlike and steady, but whatever your aeronautical style, your soaring has just that. Style. Whatever it is that makes you different, weird, unique from the others, it is that, if anything, which will see you prosper. When I managed to work that golden notion through my thick head, it was then that I knew I would be okay. Not everyone will like the cut of your jib, looking at you, Les Moonves, more on that later, but many others will. One simply needs to seek those others and then somehow trick them into buying tickets for your production of gangster rap Coriolanus. In 2012, Robin McFarquhar invited me to come back and speak to the current students of the department, 20 years after my own graduation. I leapt at the opportunity, remembering so clearly how we yearned back in my own student days for professionals working in the business to come and tell us how things stood in the big bad world outside. I sat in front of the assembled department and told them, first and foremost, to be sure not to squander their time in this facility in which we sat, the Krannert Center, which contains four gorgeous, better-than-professional-quality theaters, with accompanying scene shop, costume shop, and light and sound departments, staffed by absolute superstars of their respective crafts. I spoke to the students. I have worked all over the country in theater, film, and television, and I have sincerely never come across a bounty of resources like those contained in this one benevolently bebricked city block of artistic rectitude. You talk weird, they replied. Silence, I commanded. I went on to discuss the pros and sure, a few cons to working there as a lad, mentioning some faculty members and what have you, and then I came to speak of Robin, who was sitting off to the side, probably willing me to pick up the pace as teachers are wont to do. Let me tell you about this guy, I began, but before I could get another word out, I promptly burst into tears. Oh, sorry. I did not see this coming, I managed to utter before openly sobbing for several minutes. No shit. Even speaking this description of that scene has me welling up with gratitude for that man. Hard as it may be for you to believe, I didn't get to where I am today because I'm so cute. I'm sorry, gentle listener, I should have suggested you pull over to the side of the road before I dropped that thermonuclear shock nugget. Where I am today, by the way, is in class. A class of my own devising, based upon the generous teachings of men and women like Robin McFarquhar, to whom I would say, I shall forever don my largest cap, just so that I may doff it to your life's work. As luck would have it, when I had finished crying like a baby in front of that assembly of 20-year-olds, and I had spoken my heartfelt piece about Robin and his auspicious curriculum, another of my teachers walked through the studio door. I said, "Oh, great, and then there's this guy," and promptly renewed my sobbing. That teacher was Shozo Sato, my sensei. This is a cheap comparison, but it'll go a long way toward elucidating for you the basis of my relationship with Sato Sensei. The original version of the film The Karate Kid from 1984 features an absolutely enchanting performance by the great Pat Morita as Mr. Miyagi. If you've enjoyed the newer version with the winning Jaden Smith and Jackie Chan, then you should definitely check out the old school flavor. Shozo came into my life and immediately bewitched me and my future Defiant Theater cronies with his kabuki theater class. A traditional 400-year-old Japanese theater form, kabuki literally translates to sing, ka, dance, bu, skill or acting, ki, kabuki. This very presentational style employs some of my favorite aesthetic tricks and techniques, such as the use of silken fabrics to represent elements like water and fire and blood. To great effect, a stabbing victim might erupt ribbons of red silk from his chest, eliciting gasps from the audience. Or simply the employment of hugely broad mugging during mie poses, which are grandly expressive freeze frames on stage describing moments of great emotion. At such moments in the execution of Japanese kabuki productions, expert audience members will shout either the actor's last name, as a great compliment to the performer's skill, or even more flattering, the name of the actor's house, as well as the phrase, "You are better than your father!" The pinnacle of praise. So next time you see me in a play, it would not hurt my feelings were you to shower me with such a pronouncement. Another stroke of great fortune in my life was landing a role in Shozo's touring production of Kabuki Achilles in 1991. What started out as an enrollment in a reputedly cool class became a tour of Japan, complete with participation in an ancient theater festival in the small mountain village of Domine. In addition, three or four of my closest new buddies were in the show as well, so we were treated to quite a vacation. For most of the cast, it was our first ever international travel, and Shozo and his wife Alice did an absolutely masterful job of parenting their brood of 20 students, who were incredibly fond of sake, as it turned out. That tour was so rich with beautiful experience and detail that it rather merits its own volume, but one chapter sticks out in my memory. Because Japanese farmers lavish an exceptional amount of attention on the cultivation of their fruits, especially melons, that particular fruit is considered the finest delicacy on the Japanese menu, bringing a price astonishingly more dear than the finest steak. In Tokyo, my dear Joe Faust and I were seeking breakfast one morning in the hotel restaurant when an old gentleman noticed us buying cigarettes from a vending machine. He was very friendly, trying to communicate something to us, the meaning of which we could not discern. Gamely, we kept pointing at ourselves and stating, "Illinois Kabuki," whereupon he would grow excited and noddingly exclaim, "Hi, Kabuki, Kabuki!" He was awfully nice, buying us each a pack of smokes and continuing to energetically speak a stream of unintelligible Japanese. He even gave me an enthusiastic handshake at a certain point, which in Japan was apparently executed a little differently than I was used to. "Kabuki! Kabuki!" It grew a bit strange. Although this man was clearly a big fan of our show, which he must have seen at one of our tour stops. He brought us over to his table nearby for breakfast, it would seem, as he persistently pointed at the melon on the menu, the most premium item, so expensive we were told that it was often purchased as a gift, much like a bottle of fine champagne in the States. Eventually, we thanked him as best we could and called our friend Tetro over, explaining that this gentleman wanted to buy him some cantaloupe. Joe and I withdrew to our people, and as we explained the odd scene to the group, Shozo began to laugh very loudly. He reminded us that the word kabuki, besides representing a revered national art form, was also slang for prostitute, since the style had initially been developed by traveling bands of whores visiting the camps of warring shoguns. Well, I guess that explained the ticklish handshake. Everyone had a good laugh until we remembered Tatro. Running to his rescue, we were surprised to see him sitting with the old man, having a good chuckle, finishing up a beautiful serving of melon. "Best damn cantaloupe I ever tasted," he said. "This guy's a hoot." We never did tell him the rest. Because of my ability to carry heavy objects, Sato-sensei made me a bit of a teacher's pet. Pulling weeds in his garden one day, he casually dropped this bomb. "The act of pulling weeds has the very same impetus that causes war. We're killing these bad shoots so the ones we favor can receive all the sunlight, nutrients, and water. That's all war is, killing weeds." That was the first, but certainly not the last time I was floored by my sensei's wisdom. Over the years, he continued to call upon me for my mulish abilities, at one point hiring my classmate Mike Flanagan, another pilotus, and myself to move him and Alice to their new home in beautiful Mendocino, California. We drove the moving truck whilst Shozo and Alice drove their minivan. Filling a truck with scenery, a false world, and driving it to a new place to recreate that world anew was an act I was quite familiar with. But the notion of making that transition in real life was still quite an adventure to my way of thinking. Shozo always had a real sense of the swashbuckler about him, albeit a relatively small, graceful version. A published master of several Zen disciplines, such as kabuki theater and dance, ikebana, which is flower arrangement, sumi-e, black ink painting, Zen meditation, and the tea ceremony, Shozo had spent the year of 1981 touring the American Southwest in a van, painting the landscapes for his sumi-e book. Pretty badass. By the time I was 23, he had taken me to Japan, Hungary, Cyprus, London, and California, and had gotten me paid for most of it. Faust Flanagan and I were never the leads in his shows, as there were more beautiful actors who were better dancers, but we were dependable, so he kept us around the most. We were called upon for comic relief. In between long elegiac sequences of shifting light and undulating colorful dances in museum-quality traditional costumes of Shozo's design, we would run onto the stage, fall down, and then run off. There's room for everyone. My favorite rule from Sensei was, always maintain the attitude of a student. When a person thinks they have finished learning, that's when bitterness and disappointment can set in, as that person will wake up every day wondering when someone's going to throw a parade in their honor for being so smart. As human beings, we, by the very definition of our natures, can never be perfect. This means that as long as we are alive and kicking, we can be improving ourselves. No matter our age, if we always have a project to which we can apply ourselves, then we'll wake up every day with an objective, something productive to get done. This allows us to go to bed at night in the peaceful knowledge that we've done some good, gained some achievement, however small. Having ears for this lesson has been one of the luckiest pieces of listening I've done, because it has led to my woodworking discipline, one of the greatest joys of my life. There were less refined lessons in Shozo's textbook as well. Visiting Cyprus with a professional tour of Kabuki Achilles, we young men were housed at one point in an ancient monastery in the mountain village of Kalapaniotis. After a week or so, Shozo looked in on us and noticed that the bathroom was in a state of dishevelment, much as one might expect from six young drunk men sharing one bathroom. We were thoroughly humiliated when our sensei came fuming out of the facilities, severely admonishing us for our slobbery. "And not just here," he said, lecturing us. "Any bathroom you ever use, if there is a mess, doesn't even matter if you made the mess. The next person to use the room will think you made the mess. What if your mother was coming to use this bathroom?" Heavy. Heavy, deep shit. And true. I have never been in a messy restroom since without thinking of that day. His mentality then further ties me directly to the Wendell Berry of it all. For if we think of others, in our fastidiousness or lack thereof around the toilet, how can we not extrapolate that notion into how we're leaving the rest of the world for the others who will come to use it after us? His most all-encompassing bit of erudition is perhaps found in the Zen koan, "The way of the arts is the way of the Buddha." According to Sato Sensei, Buddhist teachings tell us that we must strive to return to the purity of the day we were born. In the performing arts, the visual arts, as well as the martial arts, when you are completely focused on your art, you're in that pure state. Therefore, the passage, the way of creating art, is the same as the way of the Buddha. I love the focus that this sensibility places on the importance of one's art in regards to a person's inner journey, as opposed to all the attention paid today to the exterior effects of artistic performance. Like Robin McFarquhar, Shōzō Sato Sensei continues to be an important influence in my life, so it seems like they're getting the pretty short end of the stick. I took their classes, I graduated, and now they have to continue to teach me? Whatever the case, they seem to persevere without complaint, which is, I suppose, the teacher's lot. When Megan and I were married in our backyard, Shōzō performed a tea ceremony for us as part of the proceedings, a rite which felt profoundly more sacred than the recitation of any corresponding Western religious dogma. Our marriage is 10 years strong as of this writing, so I guess that hearty bowl of green tea was a pretty good batch. I have been lucky enough to see and do a great deal in my 43 years of life, but I have not discovered a greater treasure than a good teacher. My only hope is that I can begin to repay them by passing their lessons along to anybody with their ears on right. Make a goddamn gift. This chapter hopes to serve as a gentle reminder to myself and all the rest of us to make our gift-giving opportunities in life count. To my way of thinking, the tradition of giving and receiving gifts has been all but ruined by the general prosperity and largesse that we enjoy in America and much of the world today. In effect, devaluing the very value and meaning of gifts themselves. The circumstance that makes us so soft as a society is to be found in our complete achievement of personal comfort. The vast majority of our nation's people can pretty much buy anything they need. Not anything they want, necessarily, but anything they need to achieve a satisfactory degree of creature comfort. Clothing, water, shoes, shelter, food. Beer, throwing stars, charcoal, Doritos, diapers, iPhone apps. You know, the staples. We're all complicit here, holding hands, or linking arms, rather, so we can look at Twitter, whilst huddled together in our handbasket, barreling straight to hell. To wit, if you had the sand to suggest to me that I lower the window of my vehicle by the method of the downright cardiovascular exercise of pumping a window crank lever around in circles, literally moving the window with my mechanical exertions, I'd pitch a fit that you could hear for a country mile. Holy good Christ, we have made things so goddamn easy for ourselves. Finding our schedules relieved of so many of the tedious household tasks that wore our parents' fingerprints off, we find ourselves with a surplus of spare time on our fleshy hands. One might proffer the suggestion that we exploit that bonus time to do something like build a canoe, or at least haul one to the creek and paddle it, reveling in the bird song and white-tailed deer that come right down on the creek banks to eat gummy bears straight from our hands. But then one might easily argue that such an activity would require some energy, some gumption, or, God forfend, some work. Wouldn't it be easier, one might continue, to remain inside upon our pillowy duffs, lollygagging in regal comfort? It's a short fall from making that choice to finding oneself online, shopping, and hey, buying things is fun. We love to buy presents for our children, our friends, and our neighbors. In America, there really is a lot of time to kill with all kinds of noble pastimes like shopping, and when you get right down to it, perhaps there is a recipient even more deserving of treats than those aforementioned beneficiaries. I do believe that, as a group, we have determined that we most prefer buying gifts for ourselves. Objects are just so easy to come by. Michael Pollan puts out a new book? Boom, pre-ordered it on Amazon. We can buy ourselves gifts before the ink is even dry on the pages there in the book machine. Once upon a time for me, something commensurate with a Michael Pollan book or a new Tom Waits record would have been the prize of my year, were I to find it waiting under my Christmas tree or unwrap it upon my birthday. I also used to thrill at receiving necessary items as presents, like simple socks or work gloves. Nowadays, I have too many gloves. Because I have purchased leather gloves online that appeared to be a good deal or just because I liked their look. Their nice cut, well-shaped fingers, add to shopping cart, click to complete order, here they come. Prosperity is a good thing, right? Having too many gloves is a state of affairs preferable to working one's hands raw, yes? Absolutely it is. No question. But for me, too many gloves is symptomatic of a larger deficit that I don't feel good about. Because I find that the greater the ease with which such bounty is purchased, at least in my case, the less the significance the giving of it contains. This is why I try harder at gifts. My first line of offense against this sort of apathy is simply understanding the impact of a little time spent. Even merely writing out a thoughtful slash funny card goes a lot further towards signaling your affection than a cute top purchased from that popular garment shopping website. Not only is it apparent that you took the time to select your words and commit them to cardstock, but by gifting a poem or a joke or a few verses of your own, you force the reader to pause in his or her rhythm and consider what you were trying to accomplish when you scribbled those words. That transaction between the two of you is the gift. In it resides a ceremony rife with tradition that outstrips, in my estimation, a great many retail goods. Short on words, draw a flower, draw a frog, draw some tits, always hilarious. Add a triangular bush below 'em for a bona fide slam dunk. P.S. Cards don't have to be your conventional folded thin cardboard or paper. Unlikely objects add a flavor of whimsy that scores a lot of points. A 2x4, a pair of underwear, a piece of fabric or leather. Go nuts. When people admonish me for making Megan a card, I say to them, you make a goddamn card for your significant other. Go to your printer. There's paper in there. Locate it and pull out a few sheets in case of mistakes. Fold one in half and draw a heart on the front. Open it up and write I love you on the inside. Sign your name. You will get kissed big time. You want the bonus round? Go outside and find a tiny piece of nature, a twig, a leaf, a pebble, a shell, a chrysalis if you're really gifted. Adhere your artifact inside the heart and then get stretched out because you're going for a ride to the realm of coitus. Once you've mastered the card, take it up a notch to handmade gifts. Ho ho! You think you like the card-fueled oral pleasurings you're receiving now? Just wait until he or she gets a load of the scarf you have knit for him or her. That won't be the only load exchanged that night. Making gifts is also a great way to perpetuate a hobby in a productive way, and a solid hobby can keep you out of the hair of your significant other. What do you know? That's another gift. Don't have the time slash budget slash inclination to take up woodworking or chandlery or glass blowing? No sweat. Step up to some tasty paper mache. I have used this childhood art class technique more times than I can count in my theater work, and it is super fun every time. Well, actually, no, probably I've just used it 17 times. I'm pretty countable. You make just enough of a mess to know that you've achieved something, and you could potentially end up with a sculpted masterpiece. Something I love to do as a character actor is to craft my own facial prosthetics for the stage, which is a fancy way of saying that I like to make funny noses. If you cast your face in plaster and then sculpt your new features in clay upon that plaster version of your face, then your noses or chins or devil horns will fit you perfectly, providing countless hours of hijinks. Other fun objects to immortalize in paper and glue are the breasts and the penis. If and when you replicate your viril member, or really any body part, it's key to coat the area with petroleum jelly to prevent an intensely painful hair removal once the papier-mâché is dry. In the case of a penis casting, one obviously needs to maintain an erection until the glue sets up, which can take several minutes, I've read, so be prepared to sustain an atmosphere of arousal for the necessary duration. Once you have achieved crafting a successful facsimile, you can also elongate the shaft of said manhood by sculpting an extra couple inches in clay, then adding more papier-mâché to the extra length, I've also read. When you are happy with your product, you might wonder what the hell you're supposed to do with a papier-mâché version of your rig. Well, I'll tell you. Create a waterproof seal on the inside of the paper dick with epoxy or spar varnish. Glue the base of the shaft to a flat rock or piece of wood to create a strong, heavy foundation. Gently cut in a urethra or pee hole with a sharp knife and paint to taste. Fill partway with water, insert a nice daisy or tea rose, and you have a darling bud vase. No matter how you decide to spend a little more time on your gestures of giving, the point is just quite simply that you do. You don't have to give a person a papier-mâché penis to get a reaction, but you won't be sorry if you do. Chapter 11. Kabuki Farm Boy Takes Chicago. As is only proper, my years in college saw me undergo a drastic personal transformation, as well as participate in a larger group consummation with those several champions who were to form the Defiant Theater. Our sage, Robin McFarquhar, has since asserted that, in the 20 years since our matriculation, he has never seen another band of students with such an unquenchable work ethic, willing to stay up all night regularly to fulfill our artistic missions of mischief and beauty. I am very grateful to hear that I, once again, was in the right place and time to be valued by these peers, despite my relative inexperience on stage. Joe Faust and Christopher Johnson, who was destined to become Defiant's first artistic director, spearheaded production teams to create pageants of theater both challenging and hilarious. A ragtag team of puckish miscreants coalesced, membership in which required only an adherence to our collective taste and the willingness to work one's fingers to the bone. The original gangsters were Johnson and Faust, Darren Kritz, Chris Kanowitz, Jen Cottelier, Rich Norwood, Kara Loquist, Richard Ragsdale, and myself, soon to be joined by Michelle P.P. Primo, Linda Gillum, Tatro, Emil Bulos, Andrew Lehman, Rob Kimmel, Lisa Rothschiller, Jim Slonina, Sean Sinitsky, Will Schutz, Barb and Chris Tomitz, and many others as the years rolled past. We capering fools were drawn inexorably together to weave shows of intelligence and silliness in a way that thrilled us and fed us completely. Joe's was my favorite brain, wickedly clever and funny for days. A naturally magnanimous leader, he had such a great sensibility for utilizing old-school theatrical conventions in a completely fresh way to incite mirth in any audience. He also wielded a fresh perspective that made him a wonderful and sensitive leader, which I have since learned is exactly the type of person in whose service I thrive. Late one stormy night, Properly buzzed, we all convened on our Nevada Street porch, festooned with fairy lights, incense, and candles, to draw up the first charter of our artistic collective, with plans to move our efforts to Chicago and thereby take over the known universe. The swollen sky hinted at great portent. We signed our names to the magnificent parchment in fire, jam, and absinthe. Lightning crashed. The four winds howled, shrieked, and yee-hawed. Neighborhood mothers shuddered in their sleep, and the frilly little gillyflowers in the south meadows wilted and shed their pretty petals. The Defiant Theater was born. As daunting as this transition seemed, we had found pockets of encouragement when we had previously visited the city of Big Shoulders. We'd taken group trips to see plays at the Goodman Theater, which had been very inspiring. It was there I first witnessed a great Chicago character actor named Steve Pickering, who was a big, thick, juggernaut sort of a guy. I saw him essay some unlikely roles for a guy built like a small tractor, such as Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet and Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream. In the opening moments of this particular production, Steve/Puck rappelled in from the lighting grid above in commando gear. There was a park bench center stage, which he examined, and then, brandishing a can of spray paint, administered the word fuck onto the bench. He furtively glanced about for passers-by, and then he turned around and transformed the F into P. Puck. This was my kind of guy. After years of being surrounded by more classically thin and frail theater gents, I was very exhilarated to see a guy who was a little more stout, like myself, getting cast in these plum roles. Having had some trouble getting cast thus far, I was reassured by Steve's success that Chicago might just have some goodness in store for me. Fortunately, just as we moved up to the city in the fall of 1993, Wisdom Bridge Theater, where my sensei Shozo had produced earlier award-winning kabuki shows over many years, like Kabuki Othello, was doing a revival of one of his biggest previous hits, Kabuki Medea, starring a couple of Chicago theater luminaries, Henry Godinez and Barbara Robertson, as Jason and Medea. Lo and behold, we three or four defiant youngsters were just moving to town with more recent kabuki training than anyone in the city of Chicago, if not the nation. Not a lot of kabuki training going on outside of Shozo's classroom. Thus, as if his training and generosity to date weren't enough, Shozo then handed us our first paychecks in our professional lives as well. Now that's a teacher. A select portion of our defiant number had already been fortunate enough to participate in a couple productions of Kabuki Achilles, having toured Japan, Hungary, and Cyprus, as well as performing it professionally outside of Philadelphia at the estimable People's Light and Theater Company for several months. Shozo's bread and butter was adapting Greek and Shakespearean tragedies into the traditional Kabuki style. The epic storylines and larger-than-life emotional arcs lend themselves perfectly to the spectacularly presentational style of Kabuki, which we studied diligently for years under our sensei. Imagine Hector and Achilles in samurai armor fighting it out with katana, samurai swords. Amazing. Amongst the defiant tribe, this experience resulted in a communal company reverence for the tried-and-true conventions of Kabuki theater, which we did not hesitate to later exploit in our own plays. Conventions like the Koken, who are basically stagehands, technically visible, but clad in full black robes and sheer black hoods that render them invisible to the audience. Koken will scurry across the stage in a sort of duck-like squat walk to assist the actors in some sort of action. For example, if the character of Medea is getting ready to, say, transform into a demon and kill her children, the Koken will come zipping out and trick her wig and kimono, whereupon they will turn into flames as if by magic. They'll simultaneously slash some streaks of red and black makeup onto her face while handing her a dagger so that in a moment's time, she is transformed from a beautiful woman into a hideous, bloodthirsty she-monster. Because of their all-black garb, the Koken aesthetically disappear into the black stage so that the transformation appears as if to be happening by magic. These tricks were developed 300 years ago, incorporating no technology beyond string and paint. Liking that price point, we immediately borrowed the Koken, as well as a general sensibility of grandeur, from Kabuki and inserted them into our own Defiant productions. We created a tonal goulash, kind of like a Shakespearean tragedy as writ by Tex Avery and Mel Brooks. My good fortune kept on rolling. The stage manager of Kabuki Medea was doing Richard II next at the Goodman, and they needed a fight captain. So, knowing that I had a penchant for the stage combat, she fortuitously hooked me into that gig. The fight captain is a member of the cast who is in charge of maintaining the choreography throughout the run of the show and helping to train the actors who need help with their technique. If they had been looking for anything like a good actor, I would not have gotten the nod, but they fortunately just needed a guy handy with the slapstick. To my delight, the former fuck-slash-puck Steve Pickering was also cast in Richard II as one of the main combatants, so we got to work together almost as soon as I had landed in Chicago. The cherry on top of this excellent pastry was that Robin McFarquhar had been hired up from Champagne to choreograph the fights. Christ, could I have gotten any luckier? My first two pro gigs in Chicago were with my two greatest teachers, Shozo and Robin. Pickering took a bit of a shine to me and enlisted me to work on The Old Man and the Sea with him at the Next Theater in a nifty adaptation of Hemingway's classic story with four dancers and some puppets, which were my department. I did the Man of War Bird and the Marlin as articulated puppets that could flap and fly for their moments in the spotlight. The four dancers, with masks and a small boat, performed movements that accompanied the words of the piece, describing the action and the sea and other elements with their beautifully effective progressions. I also choreographed quarterstaff fights between the old man and the Marlin and then the sharks. This was awesome, at least at first. I had immediately hooked up with my hero, Pickering, and he rewarded me with a fine lesson. Nobody could do what the Defiant Theater did. Working with Steve was mostly fun, but he was a self-proclaimed benign dictator. Since gigs like these paid little to nothing, there was no apparent reason to continue a collaboration that was not nearly as satisfying as that with my own company. I'm terribly grateful for the time I got to spend with Pickering and for the lessons I took away from his example, but from then on, I would focus my free work upon the Defiant stage. Speaking of, we established our company quickly, and we found a great little niche audience. Everyone in the company was making a meager income by whatever means we could scare up, but we were all very satisfied to have the opportunity to make some great theater. I could afford cigarettes, coffee, burritos, beer, and weed. I wanted for nothing, and I was making theater 16 hours a day. I was lucky that my day job was also working in theaters as a carpenter, especially compared to many of the company members who had temp jobs in offices or other equally depressing grinds. There was one slow winter, however, that saw a few of us reduced to this quasi-telemarketing job set up by another charismatic Kabuki alumnus named Goldberg, who played our actual Achilles. The job was to sit in a cubicle and call cardiologists on the phone to ask them to review a new perfusion catheter that they had been utilizing. Adding to the bizarre flavor of the experience was the fact that the company had located its offices directly over the Fulton Street Fish Market, so this cool brick warehouse absolutely reeked of fish. Anyway, a perfusion catheter is a tiny balloon that is threaded into blood vessels around the heart. If memory serves, they would insert it down in the thigh, I suppose utilizing the femoral artery, and snake this catheter up into blocked regions around the actual heart, whereupon the balloon would be inflated, effectively opening up the blockage. How crazy is that shit? And how bizarre for a bunch of barely employed actors to sit around discussing it over the phone with these surgeons who utilize the technology every day. The upshot of that tedious gig was that we fired up a fun competition amongst a few of us wage slaves. One chap would go into the bathroom right there at the side of the room and commit the sin of onane, beat off. Then, upon exiting, he would strike the glass light sconce on the wall next to the bathroom door with the eraser end of his pencil, which would cause it to ding like the bell at a boxing match, signifying a tally of exactly one successfully blown load. We would all keep score, each adding to his or her total at every possible opportunity throughout the day, until, at the end of an 8-hour shift, the winner would be feted with beers by the other participants. One of my cronies, whom we'll call Richard Krishna, and I were usually vying for the title, and I believe my record for sconce dings in a day of work was no less than 9. You see, no matter how dreary your job, ways can be found of passing the time productively. At Defiant, we prided ourselves on building our sets and props for next to no budget, often from scraps we would collect in the fruitful alleyways of Chicago. I was the technical director, or TD, which simply means I had all the tools. We depended heavily upon each company member to come out and help with each build, but there were a few core stalwarts who brought most of the magic home. Joe Faust could literally make anything out of gaffer's tape. A condition born of necessity, but I was to learn later how valuable our poverty actually was to our creativity. Bigger theaters with a healthy budget could do things like drive a motorcycle onto the stage or build an entire 2-story house set, whereas we would have to make our motorcycle or our 2-story house out of refrigerator boxes and egg cartons. The amazing thing I learned was that audiences enjoyed ours more. If a crowd witnessed an actual motorcycle rev and roll on stage, that's a neat spectacle, which then immediately fades, as in, oh, wow, a real motorcycle. And then it's over, the exceptional but momentary delight of seeing an unexpected but recognizable quantity. But when an audience has to buy into whatever illusion you've created, say a motorcycle made out of 2 people with some mailing tubes and 2 umbrellas, then they experience the delight of creating the object together with the performers in the imagination. That's more fun and abiding for them because they are part of the transaction, as opposed to just sitting and coldly observing. An audience loves to have a hand in making the magic real, which is what I think should be connoted by the term an engaging piece of theater. Our shows were just plain really fun, and in one way, the greatest work of my life. The group of artists and the freedom that we had at the time allowed us to create and perform pieces unhindered by obligations, financial or otherwise. An artist cannot do his or her best work unless he or she feels the necessary freedom to do so. For me, this freedom culminated in Defiant's 3rd season, particularly in our production of Ubu Raw. What is considered by history to be the first absurdist play, Ubu Raw, spelled R-O-I, or Ubu the King, was written in France in the late 19th century by a gassy guy named Alfred Jarry. Our original translation, penned by Faust and Ragsdale, was called Kabuki Ubu Raw, spelled R-A-W. In both cases, it's sort of a filthy Macbeth story. Jarry initially wrote it as a puppet show making fun of his science teacher. When first produced in Paris, Pa Ubu entered and proclaimed his first line, "Merde! Shit!" The theater rioted at the profanity, and they shut the show down. There's a lot of innuendo, like, "Buy my green candle," which, considered nothing short of pornographic at the time, is now completely tame. But more on Ubu Raw later. We few core company members, our lives were fueled almost entirely by the ambition of youth. None of us ever had quite enough to eat, but we would work late into the wee hours of the night just the same. In a play called The Quarantine, I was acting in the show, so I'd rehearse the show from 6 until 10, then I'd go backstage to my tools and work on the set, or a life-size dummy of me, complete with a life-cast foam latex head for, what else, the disemboweling scene. I remember one night driving a 3-inch screw into my own knee on the dummy, and actually thinking, this is awesome, and also kinda weird. I'd think, it's opening night tomorrow night, or I guess tonight. It's 3 in the morning. I'm gonna get maybe about 3 hours of sleep from maybe 5 to 8 a.m. This is the greatest fucking life. Exhaustion would occasionally catch up with me. There's a scene in Ubu Raw in which a 6-foot ladder with a 2-dimensional boulder attached to its front is placed center stage, and I could, as the titular Pa Ubu, stand astride the boulder by climbing up the ladder and straddling the top. On the night of our final preview performance, I climbed up, struck a pose, then passed out and fell forward onto my head. After laughing for a while, Joe realized something was wrong when I got to my feet and began whispering my lines. He came out to stop the show, and I said insistently, "No, no, I'm okay," like a goddamn 5-year-old. I was about to commence a broadsword fight with the character Bugger Ass, but Joe took away my broadsword. We collected ourselves and then finished the show, minus the fights. When I first moved to Chicago, I lived with Joe and Ragsdale and Tatro in an awesomely crappy apartment at Chicago and Ashland in a pretty bad neighborhood. It was an old storefront that had been converted into a living space, which meant a kitchenette and bathroom had been installed, but no other rooms, so we built our own. Short on materials, to say the least, we just built 4 bedrooms with 8-foot-high walls, the length of a sheet of plywood, leaving a couple feet of open air above the walls. Not exactly the most ideal situation when it came to privacy, but we were like family by this point anyway. One night I was walking home to this hovel from the L train with my friend Rob Eck, who, while sweet as pie, was a very intimidating, manly guy in our tribe of troublemakers. He was the one everybody thought of as macho, not me. Nobody in those days ever inquired of me, "How did you become so manly?" because I was usually standing next to Rob Eck. So we were walking home from the train one night, having taken some pints on board, when we had an unexpected social interaction with a few young men, teenagers really, who had appeared suddenly. I must have been juking about in a silly way, obliviously lost in my buzz, which they mistook for crazy. The main guy was spooked by my strangeness, and he quickly said to us, "Yeah, you better run," and then they all took off. Rob grabbed me and said, "Holy shit, did you see that?" I said, "No, what?" Unbeknownst to me, in my stupor, the guy was showing us a silver pistol in his waistband, telling us to give him our money. The depth of my intoxication revealed itself as Rob walked me through the details of what I had just missed. I went about as white as a sheet, and we realized that the perpetrators must have thought I was crazy. Well, it worked that time well enough, so I took the ball and ran. I began cultivating this scary look, as I realized that being perceived as insane was a great defense late at night in the big city. I wore mutton chops and a brown cowboy hat that looked like something out of High Plains Drifter, and under a brown overcoat I favored this black classic motorcycle jacket with an airbrushed image of a skull on the back and the words, "Watch me burn," beneath it. The phrase had a number of meanings. I've always enjoyed these triple-layered entendres. No one ever knew what the fuck I meant, but I thought I was being incredibly clever and hilariously rebellious. Part of the inspiration came from the summer after my sophomore year in college, when I was really trying to distance myself from my bucolic, wholesome upbringing. I was also coming down off a born-again Christian trip, so there's that. I was working for these born-again Christian house builders for the summer in Minooka. It was incredible, and I worked like an ox. We were framing houses, and I was carrying 4x8 sheets of plywood up an extension ladder to the second and third story roofs. Looking back on it, it was an act of stamina that makes me long for the strength of my younger self. I'm still strong and have a great constitution, but you have to be 18 or 19 and a little stupid to haul plywood like that. At that age, nobody's terribly impressed that you can haul a sheet up, so you haul two of them. Yeah, you guys didn't notice? I did too. No big. Even as a brute laborer, I needed